Welcome to the Religious Studies Collective. You're listening to the interview series coming to you from Western Sydney University. My name is Milad Milani. The interview series offers conversations that tackle the big questions and the small in relation to religion. Join me and my guests as we delve into issues, topics, and challenges shaping religion today. Along the way, we'll go back in time, not literally, of course, but through the minds of great thinkers who have left us with timeless ideas, still provoking and inspiring us to this day. Right, my guest today is Mark G.E. Kelly, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Western, and the author of six books on the thought of Michel Foucault. His most recent book, Normal Now, Individualism as Conformity, published by Polity, offers a fascinating exploration of how individualism today often operates as a form of conformity. Mark and I will be delving into the concept of the norm as we discuss his book and its implications. But as we know, Michel Foucault's concept of the norm sheds light on how modern societies use models of perfection to evaluate and regulate individuals. For Foucault, the norm is a central mechanism in the exercise of power, shaping behavior, and establishing societal control. We'll delve deeper into Foucault's understanding of the norm with Mark, but before we begin, it might be worthwhile reflecting on the double-edged nature of normalization. While normalization is undeniably rooted in culture and values, it isn't always necessarily negative. In fact, one can argue normalization often helps shift perceptions, sometimes from negative to positive, about people, places, and ideas. Consider this: what defines the norm of a place? What is normal now compared to what was normal before? And here's the ultimate question: am I normal? Perhaps Mark can help me untangle these vexing questions. Let's find out. Mark, welcome to the program. It's great to have you with us.
Hi, Milad. It's great to be here.
Mark, if I may, I have quite a lot of questions for you. Reading your book, very exciting adventure for me, understanding your thought and thinking in writing it. And I appreciate the time that you're giving us today to speak to us about your book. So if I may, I'll begin with my first question.
Please.
Okay. I thought we could start by asking you more broadly about your connection to Foucault and how you work with his theories, and likewise how you implement these into your academic work. For example, in your book, Foucault plays an important role as you think through the issues with his theories in mind, but he is present as you render him, and he does not play a dominant role. That is, the book is not Foucauldian in the strict sense, as you outline, but it's very much Foucauldian in another way, which is in the way that his thought has influenced yours, as you say in the book, and your thinking on the manifold issues raised in the book, such as sex, politics, life, and law, revisit these age-old questions. Would you like to speak a little bit to your application of Foucault, and perhaps for the benefit of the listener, a brief overview of some of the broad strokes of his thought? To put it into context, what would you say is the value of studying Foucault today?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a lot to address there. Thanks for that question. So if I put it, very simply, I mean, Foucault is my guy in, that I did a PhD on his thought, and three of those six books you mentioned earlier are like directly about Foucault's thought. I mean, I'm a Foucault scholar. I continue to write on Foucault, this is largely simply because of the way academic life works, and once you're an expert in something, you're continually forced back to write on it. But it's also, also because like I'm so steeped in Foucault that it's very hard for me to get away from approaching things through that lens. And yeah, the other books I've read which aren't directly about Foucault, including one that has Foucault's name in the title, I mean they're using Foucault's ideas in like as the central kind of jumping off point. But the other stuff that's in there. With this book, I mean, you speak about it not being Foucauldian, and I do have these kind of provisos at the beginning, this shouldn't be mistaken for a kind of Foucauldian study, but it really depends what you mean by Foucauldian. Of course, I have to explain that. I mean, you've asked me to say a little bit about Foucault's thought, and Foucauldian is the adjective from Foucault's name. What does it mean to be Foucauldian? And, it's not necessarily terribly clear. I mean, there's not. I don't think Foucault is particularly unusual in this regard. There's not a single way of doing things that marks all of Foucault's work. And Foucault was active, wrote like a bunch of books over a 20-year period. There's not a single thing that he's saying across all of that work. I mean, you can find some commonalities between them, but really, by the end of his career, I think you'd be hard pushed to find a single agenda. I mean, Foucault himself actually in his later years retrospectively claims that he was always concerned about the relationship, as he put it, between subjectivity and truth. But it would be a pretty surprising statement at certain points in his career he's not that interested in subjectivity in an explicit way. So Foucault is influential in a lot of ways. So there's at a base level, you've already talked about it. This concept of the norm you mentioned earlier as being a perfect image. I take it this is Foucault's concept of the norm, as I say in the book, and I've written a journal article where I talk about this in journal article on Foucault studies, titled "What's in a Norm." I talk about this in some technical detail. Actually, most readers of Foucault don't agree with me that Foucault thinks that a norm is a perfect image. That guides things. I think it's pretty clear that he does think that, but this is a, let's say, controversial position in Foucault studies. So at the base, that there is this concept of the norm that comes from Foucault, which is that like the primary conceptual tool that I use in this book. And Foucault invites people in his thought to do this, to take some tools out of his thought and use them. But there's also a high level at which what I'm doing here is Foucauldian, and it's kind of the middle ground where it isn't. So a lot of the specific things I say about our society and our culture in the book are, of course, not things that Foucault said. I mean, of course, he kind of couldn't have done that because he died 40 years ago and didn't see a lot of the stuff I'm talking about. As I said in the book, I don't want to presume that like Foucault would have said this. It's not that I'm just following through his analysis. In many ways, I'm disagreeing with him, or I'm diverging, probably would be more accurate. I'm not directly contradicting him very much, but I'm diverging from what he said or developing it in ways that he might well not have. But there is a convergence at a high level in the sense that the broad gesture of, or the maybe gesture is the wrong word, the broad move I make in the book is to do a kind of historical analysis. It's historicizing much in the way Foucault's work always is, to say, well, here's something that's been invented, the norm, at a particular point, and it's going through particular mutations, and it's related to power in our society. So the broad way I'm doing it is Foucauldian. The other way, though, I'm not Foucauldian is in my methodology, which is very loose compared to Foucault. I mean, to be a little bit self-deprecating about it. And Foucault, he was a very rigorous archivist. So his work was always based on having done a lot of reading. Whereas what I do, and it's also tends to be very historical, Foucault's work. Most of his work is based on materials at least 100 years more before his writing. Whereas for me, this is like it's a much lighter kind of contemporary cultural analysis where I look at things go. I mean, it would be hard to follow Foucault's methods, actually. I think today, the internet in a way is the archive of our times. It's not if you're on social media, you're seeing these kind of contemporary discourses unfold in front of you. It's a very different object. It didn't really exist in Foucault's day, but Foucault was always focused on academic discourses. Whereas, although I do obviously touch on them, and I am an academic, so it's not like I'm unfamiliar with them. Like I'm much more interested in kind of pop culture in a way.
Yeah. Brilliant. Brilliant. Understand. And that, I appreciate that response, and I think that's fair. And that makes a lot of sense. It's very hard to follow on from exactly what some of these, if I may say, great thinkers of the past do. Whether we love them or hate them, it's difficult to replicate them, and nor should be, perhaps. Now, let me ask you. You speak about another thinker in your work, and you say that you've engaged with, along with Foucault. And if I pronounce this correctly, his name is Georges Canguilhem. How important is he to your work? And can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, look, Canguilhem's importance here, it's kind of seminal to my work and also to Foucault's, specifically on the norm. I mean, it's more he's more influential to Foucault more broadly. Canguilhem's one of a number of French philosophers of science who were around in the mid-20th century. The other guy who's really big in this space is a guy called Gaston Bachelard. And the Canguilhem and Bachelard, I mean, generally not well known in the English-speaking world, even probably particularly not well known in philosophy of science. They were doing philosophy of science in quite a different way to the way it's been done in the English-speaking world. They're very influential on Foucault, and also on before Foucault on Foucault's mentor Louis Althusser and on some younger guys who were around the publication. Cahiers pour l'analyse, which is put together by these students of Althusser. Althusser famously in this period had Foucault wasn't quite his student because they're quite close in age. But then, following on from Foucault, you had a bunch of people like Étienne Balibar, Alain Badiou to some extent, who were in the wake of Althusser. But they were super interested in or super influenced, probably is a more accurate way of putting it, by the French philosophy of science. And so the gesture that's made in Bachelard and Canguilhem, which is so influential on Althusser and Foucault and these guys who come after, is the way they look at breaks. I mean, there's different words you use, ruptures, coupure, which means break in history of ideas. And this is absolutely seminal to Foucault's whole approach in his historical work. So the idea that at certain points of time, there's like sudden and marked changes which reorganize thinking. So and this is it's fairly close to independently what Kuhn did in the English speaking philosophy of science.
Understand.
That's the overall importance of Canguilhem, but that's not really specifically what's important for me. I mean, what's important for me is much more directly what Canguilhem had to say about the norm. So Canguilhem wrote a book called The Normal and the Pathological. Canguilhem was a Before he was a philosopher of science, he was a medical doctor, or he did his training as a medical doctor. So he was his doctoral work was his not his doctoral work to become a medical doctor, his doctoral work to become an academic was on this question of normality in medicine. And this is really important. It's a seminal moment. It's seminal to all of Foucault's writing on this topic. It's seminal to my account. And it seminal, I sort of keep using the word seminal. And it's seminal to, also in the order of the historical order in which things progress. So what Canguilhem is talking about is the development of normality in medicine. And my take is that actually is where what we understand as normality today gets going. In fact, it's pretty clear, at least at the level of the lexical level of the use of the word normal, that's the case, that n normal really begins as a kind of specialist medical term. I mean, this is one thing that I try and emphasize in the book, that the word normal, it's a normal word for us, right? It's a word people use every day. That wasn't the case until the early 20th century. So this would have been in the 19th century, quite a technical term. Ordinary people wouldn't have used it, and it didn't exist before that. I mean, it didn't exist in 200, or go 300 years that no one, the word didn't exist. So the importance in medicine of normality, and this goes back to your point about normalizing possibly being a good thing. I mean, the key example of normalizing being, or having a conception of the normal being a good and important thing is in modern medicine. You basically can't have modern medicine without it. You can't have modern medicine without a standard, which is what I think normality is about. You say, well, this is normal human functioning, this is healthy human functioning, and therefore, because we know what healthy human functioning looks like, we can say this person is sick and this person needs some medicine. That's how it was invented in the medical world. The problem that Congian approaches, which is fascinating, is just the question of how you decide what is normal. And this is something that he basically thought, and rightly, that he thought it was taken for granted by the doctors, the medical scientists of his day. I think this remains completely true. It's taken for granted that we can have an objective standard of normality, that you can, we can easily work out or infer from empirical evidence where the norm is. I mean, Congian's point, again, this is a little bit like the kind of thing that Kuhn has to say in relationship to the development of science, but his point, Congian's point, is that this isn't the case. You can't get the norm in human health from empirical analysis. If you did empirical analysis, you'd just go, well, this is what most people are like. Most people aren't healthy, though. The standard of health is perfection. It's not something you find on the average or among most people. It's not the mean either, because most people could be fat, right? Rather than, I mean, if I put it very crudely, right? If most people are overweight, that doesn't mean you shift the norm of ideal body weight, up. It is where it is based on healthy functioning. But yeah, the idea of healthy functioning, it's a purely normative, as we might say, standard. It's not a standard of statistical normality. It's a standard of basically a moral principle. We've decided this is where it is. But as I say, I think in medicine this is a good and necessary thing. If you don't have that, you can't have modern medicine. So absolutely necessary, but it does lead to all kinds of problems. And I mean, I'm kind of alluding to them in this example I'm giving, and this is something I talk about in the book, and it's very contested today, and people really don't like to be made to be feel to feel abnormal, understandably. And of course, most people now, like me, are fat to some extent, and they don't, we're not happy about being labeled in this way as overweight and so on by the medical establishment. Obviously, there's two things you can do about that, but yeah, there's a lot of pushback in this area, and this is this opens up the big problem with normality, as I put it in the book, which is its metastasis, obviously a medical metaphor, but its metastasis beyond the purely medical realm. If it was a matter of doctors labeling people as normal or abnormal in a diagnostic space without that having a broader cultural significance, it wouldn't have a problem. The problem is precisely that this idea of whether people are normal or not has spread out into society and become a kind of psychological preoccupation people have, that it is not just there as a heuristic for medical diagnosis. It's become a preoccupation of our society.
So this gives me a sense from listening to you describe the what's at stake in connection with Canguilhem's work and thought. There is a little bit of disciplinary focus, if that's the right word here, involved. And so I'm thinking there's certain kind of value here at play in terms of how we look at things, what lens are we analyzing them or assessing them, observing them, if you will. And so, it got me thinking about how, to what extent would I be correct, for example, in describing your book as philosophical, and indeed your work as philosophical on this. Would you agree with that description?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I mean, I sometimes think that I'm really now, I'm a philosopher in the sense that I'm trained in philosophy, right? So all my degrees are in philosophy, and I teach philosophy. It's my kind of bread and butter. But Yeah, whether what I'm doing here is really philosophy, I mean, it's certainly the case that a lot of philosophers wouldn't think so. This, of course, leads us to the difficult question of what philosophy is, which probably we shouldn't attempt to answer. I mean, there's a one thing I say to students, like doing introduction to philosophy, because we have to approach this question. But one thing I say is that what is philosophy is a philosophical question. So if we get into this, then we're doing philosophy. But it's also the case that, I mean, philosophy, it's kind of a discipline of leftovers, right? It used to be that philosophy was just a byword for science. You had philosophia from the Greek and scientia from the Latin. They met this meant the same thing. And then as the kind of hard sciences decided to kind of carve off their own domain, philosophy was what was left over, an increasingly small area of questions that were left over that weren't being approached by hard scientists. From that point of view, I guess you could claim this is philosophy. I mean, I'm personally not tremendously invested in the question of whether what I'm doing is philosophy. The other obvious thing you could claim that it is, I suppose, is some form of sociology, cultural sociology. I mean, Foucault himself gets accused of being a sociologist. Certainly not something he would ever have self-applied that term. But I mean, he at the end of his life, or towards the end of his life, was saying he was a philosopher, but it was based on a redefinition of philosophy as the study of the relationship between politics and truth, which is not classically what philosophy is considered to be. So yeah, I mean, in some sense, it's philosophy. Sociology is probably the most other obvious thing. I mean, maybe it could be classified as cultural studies or critical theory, or I mean, in the end, it's, I guess, not that important to me.
I mean, I know you kind of see why I'm asking this, because for all of us, I guess this is the kind of the academic dilemma of the day. What is your discipline? Where do you sit, and what do you actually do, and how do you add value? And I guess a lot of us kind of fend off attacks from other disciplines by way of our own discipline, or draw boundaries as to how we do the discipline that we're involved in. But I like that you say you're not invested in philosophy.
I mean, I guess if this was an interview for a philosophy job and I was asked this question, that's not what I would say.
Mark, secretly,
But
this is actually. So
okay, so I've stuffed it
no,
up.
it's okay. You got the job, because that was the correct answer. We're looking for someone who can rise above philosophy. No, seriously, I love this question, and I love that you say that asking about philosophy is in fact doing philosophy. True, it's the leftover discipline from what the other hard sciences have done. But in a way, I think, and I know I'm trying to put a positive turn on this, spin on this. It's good. It's kind of like, all right, you guys have decided that you just want to work on those specific things. Here's what's left that's, yet to be figured out, or can't be figured out and must continue to be reflected upon and thought about. And so this is why, when I was reading your book, I was thinking, I guess I wanted to hear your thoughts about this issue of discipline and how we look at things. And I've got a good sense about it. It's kind of like the philosophical response you gave me, and I love that. It reading through it, all the topics, I repeat again, sex, life, politics, and so forth. Very topical, obviously. It just kept making me reflect on some of the classical philosophical texts, Aristotle, Plato. And this question of the good life kept popping up in my mind, reading it, and thinking to myself, I'm trying to, I guess your thinking. Were you thinking that you want to come kind of somehow revive this philosophy, this thought, this questioning about the good life for the modern reader, because it has some value today, because you may want more people to think about it, in terms of this issue of what is normal, what is not, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
I hope I'm making sense here.
No, you are totally. I mean, look, it's tremendously complimentary to me that you read my work and think about Plato and Aristotle. Possibly it's largely coincidental. I mean, it's look, this is a great question. And, you know, as I say, I'm a philosopher by training. And that stuff's, I mean, it's buried quite deeply here, but yeah, you're absolutely right. It is in the kind of back of my mind. And actually, the thing that really comes to the front of my mind when you speak about this is how difficult I found it when I was an undergraduate and I had to read Aristotle's Ethics for the first time. Because ethics is really what we're talking about here. It's this area of philosophy. But this is something that Foucault's written a great deal about, right? And his last work was all around Greek ethics. So, I mean, not all of it, but you know, like the last 4 years of his life, that was really his interest. Quite distinct from his earlier interests, a very different historical period, very different conceptual framework. But this is absolutely what I'm tending towards. It's what you see in the conclusion to the book. What I was just reminiscing about is, you know, when I first encountered Aristotle as a student in, you know, moral theory class, Aristotle didn't make sense to me. Like, I really felt I was beating my head against a rock reading the Nicomachean Ethics when I was like 20. And unlike contemporary, when I say modern ethics, I should say really rather contemporary. I mean, I was like a Kantian, you know, like the Immanuel Kant's work, but I understood the other stuff. The ethical frameworks of the modern era all made sense to me. And what Aristotle's doing was powerfully different. And I never really understood Aristotle until I read Foucault on this matter some years later. It's Foucault's reading that opened up this understanding of ancient ethics. And Foucault's going back to ancient ethics is an attempt, precisely as you're suggesting here, to recover ancient ethics. But if I just spell out a little bit what the difference is, for me, it's a difference that's really covered in the book in Normal Now by me, in the sense it's contemporary ethics is about norms. Contemporary ethics, you might expect, right? It's normative ethics, is what everyone says, without really talking very much about what normativity is, in my experience. I mean, even when they do talk about it, I feel like they don't really get to the heart of it. It's about having a vision of a perfect life. You talk about the good life before, but that's something slightly different. It's like, well, this is what you should do. Here is a framework for deciding what you should do. And it also bleeds very heavily into politics, political philosophy in the contemporary way contemporary philosophy is done. So it's like, this is how the world should be organized. This is how people should behave. And here's how you should decide how you should behave. That's it. Ethics has it. It's almost like a scientific enterprise, rational enterprise to tell people what the perfect way to behave is. It's normative in that sense. Ancient Greek ethics, obviously, it's normative in some sense, in some broad sense. It does, you know, it's concerned with saying what you should do. But it's not organized around perfection in the same way. Of course, here, Plato and Aristotle, despite, you know, one being the teacher of the other, are absolute opposite poles. Aristotle really is the classic Greek ethicist par excellence. I mean, Plato's not concerned with ethics to quite the same degree. For Aristotle, ethics is about, you know, this is what ethics means originally. Ethics is from this Greek word etike, which means character. And it's about, at least to talk about etike arete, the excellence of character. That's what it aimed towards. But it's also about asceticism, about asceticism in a certain sense, not we might associate it being ascetical with an extreme form of self-denial, but for the ancient Greeks, it was about consciously shaping the practices of your life. So Aristotle, I think, is again, is typical or maybe even seminal to the Greek approach here, but and also the Roman approach, which is downstream from the Greek. But this idea that what we have to do as human beings is have a life which is a not just good but also beautiful life. It's not just an aesthetic shaping but an aesthetic object. So we have a life, we have to lead it in a certain way, with virtue, and it's not just about acting, you know, according to a universal law, as Kant would say, but doing things that are appropriate to us. I mean, this is something that you get in Aristotle's ethics. Like, if you have particular tendencies, you need to adopt practices to change those. It's understood holistically, and it's understood as something that's about you, the entirety of your life. As Aristotle said, you know, with, in Nicomachean Ethics, if you have a, whether you have a good life or not depends on the broad overview of your whole life from beginning to end. It's not just about, you know, doing the right thing at the right moment. And it, yeah, there's not one answer. It's an art. It's an art form for the ancient Greeks. You know, Plato, of course, is often blamed with, you know, this is obviously Nietzsche's view of Plato. You know, Plato really, before Aristotle's even done the thing, and of course when we say Plato, we're talking about Plato and Socrates, are accused of doing the opposite, right? Because for Plato, you know, this whole this life, this world, it's a poor shadow of perfection, and we need to reach perfection. But that's quite a different thing. I mean, this, I don't think I talk about Plato in this book at all, but what I do talk about quite a bit is Christianity, which is obviously there's a lot of different tendencies in Christianity, but broadly speaking, I would characterize Christianity as Neoplatonist. And so Christianity inherits, obviously there's some influence of Aristotle there, but it inherits this idea that there is a genuine perfection we have to reach to, but it's beyond this life. And this is what disappears in European thought in the modern period. So this is why modern ethics is the way it is, and it's why our normalizing society is the way it is, because there's this attempt to reach perfection now. This is the difference with Christianity, and indeed with going back to Plato, which is because in this world you can't actually attain perfection, it belongs to a different world, all you can do is try to approximate or attune yourself to it in this world. Whereas because in, you know, I mean, and I know, you know, I'm anticipating that perhaps you'll disagree about this, but because of, you know, our world, the worldview we have now, so as a society, and Western society, is so radically secularized. I mean, this goes even for a lot of people who are Swadhisthan religious or Christian. There's this deferral is deeply unpalatable, to the point that people refuse to accept it. Things have to be perfect now. There's no possibility of saying, well, you know, I'm doomed to imperfection in this life. And I think that's really signally what's happened.
Wow. Yeah. I love that response. I think for me too, the issue kind of lies in that pivot between, or that tension, if you like, between Plato and Aristotle. And I think that's critical for any kind of thinking around these issues. And I think what I realized in reading your book is that you make this constant reference to happiness, right? So I had a quote here from your book, actually, regarding happiness, which is what kept making me think of Aristotle in particular and the Nicomachean Ethics and this question of ethics. And obviously you're very upfront about the point being about it's an ethical point. It's about happiness. But for me, it was always this question in my mind was, you know, as you described before, how do we attain this happiness? Is this happiness something even attainable in this world, or are we just kind of fooling ourselves? Are we falling into line, being normalized, thinking, right, yes, you can do this, it's possible. And there's a massive, as you know, market of self-help literature that sort of plays to this. And to be fair, it tries to service this need. And some of the literature I've read in that area is quite exhilarating. It's very, very empowering. But yeah, you do mention Christianity quite consistently throughout the book, and I also enjoyed that comparison. I think is fundamental in my view. So I'm in agreement with you on that, and I think the way that you've used it is very effective, because it contrasts that Neoplatonic outlook, as you noted, with this kind of shift to a modern individualistic pursuit of happiness, if I can put it that way. And therein lies a tension again. And it seems to me, again, reviving that Plato and Aristotle contrast and tension again. And of course, I would maybe slide in a little bit of contention regarding variations of Christianity and sort of some of its more mystical understanding, such as theosis and the application of that in the achievement of some kind of perfection, though not the ultimate one, obviously, and so on and so forth. But I mean, we don't need to get into too much of that at
Well,
the moment.
but I mean, I think theosis goes to the point. I was thinking about that actually before you mentioned it while you were talking.
Right.
But yeah, because theosis remains, Platonistic as a concept insofar as you only finally achieve it when you die. So although there's a genuine hope of perfection there. It's perfection that this life is only working towards. I mean, actually, I think here when we talk about tension between Aristotle and Plato, I think this tension is reconciled in Christianity in a certain way, which is to say, well, we can take
Yes.
the insights of Aristotle, which are very focused on this life, and then
Yes.
turn them towards a kind of Platonistic aim
Right.
in overcoming the world, right? So, but then you have, so I mean, obviously you can be a total Platonist and a Gnostic on the one hand, or you can be a total Aristotelian and be a Stoic. But Christianity somehow it's both Neoplatonist and Neo-Stoic. That's the other thing. It kind of brings both of them together. I feel there was something else I was about to say, but maybe I'll.
No, I agree with you, and I like the way that you put that. And I think, for me, I guess I prefer to move away from the stark contrasts of sort of interpretations that create a dualism of sorts. Whereas, it's the kind of reading of Christianity that sees it as sort of suspending everything until the end of time. You kind of do what you can, versus you can do everything now, and now is it, and there's nothing after this sort of thing. It seems these two dogmas are kind of butting heads a little bit.
Well, that's right. I mean, what I was going to say, actually, I've remembered, and it's something I
Good.
mentioned very
I
briefly in the
was
book,
stalling.
but it's something that's good work. It's something I mean, it's something that Foucault touched on briefly in his first volume, which is History of Sexuality. But there's a move made in Western Christianity in the modern period that attempts to say you can achieve something or perfection now. So I mentioned in the book really briefly, John Wesley, the founder of Methodism,
Yes.
has this idea of Christian perfectionism. So this idea that we might actually become sinless, which is something that ex doesn't exist in historic Christianity, right? That there's a, you could perfection is just to be achieved after death. And there's a Catholic movement called Redemptorism around the same time. I mean, I'm not really very familiar with it, but I believe makes a similar move. And this is, I mean, it's something I talk about at length with different examples in the book, but more contemporary ones. But I think it's interesting that actually what Christianity itself is not immune to this change in the culture, that it itself is kind of becomes more temporally focused during this period.
Yeah, no, I like that. Let me just give that quote from your book, which I had written down, and it grabbed me. So I just think it might be worthwhile, and then you can tell me if we've addressed those concerns. You say, quote, "Some general motives that most, or perhaps even all of us have, such as wanting to be healthy and happy. These general human goals seem to me precisely to have become subsumed by a more general and distinctively modern drive to be normal. Happiness, as we understand it today, is our affective norm, as health is our medical one."
Yeah.
Have we addressed that?
I mean, not fully, because one thing we didn't mention, but is often like the it's the key concept people talk about with Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, is this Greek concept of eudaimonia,
Right, yes.
which is typically translated into English as happiness.
Right.
but I don't think corresponds to what we think of as happiness today. So what I say in the book, you know, is that the way people think about happiness today, I think, is generally understood to be an affect, as it indicated in that quote. So
Yes.
it's a way I feel. I feel happy, like, you know, like the song. And it's therefore it's a hedonistic conception. It's like a form of pleasure, but it, you know, maybe it like slightly more durable than pleasure, but it's closely related to pleasure. I mean, I talk
Right.
about in the book, you know, we're a hedonistic society. People want to feel pleasure all the time, and happiness is basically, you know, it's okay if I feel a lot of pleasure, if I'm having a lot of pleasurable experiences, then I will have this overall experience of happiness. I mean, this is absolutely not what Aristotle is getting at with eudaimonia. Eudaimonia is this idea of assessing someone's life as being good and valuable. So if you're to have eudaimonia, I mean, one thing he says that, referring to, you know, how my mind just couldn't get around the ethics, and I've already talked about this, for Aristotle, if you had like a perfectly good, nice life and then you died in a horrible way, you would not have eudaimonia,
Right.
on Aristotle's conception, because it's a holistic thing. It's, if eudaimonia is like someone would say this person had a good life. So, you know, if someone's disgraced, whereas I think, yeah, the way it's now understood, I mean, there's a kind of, I mean, I talk a little bit about the kind of euthanasia debate in the book, but there's a kind of perverse way this is understood now, whereas the thing that would ruin your life is not, is if you had an unpleasant, if your life was filled with pleasure, but then you had suffering in your final years. But that, of course, it's not what Aristotle's talking about. He's about talking about, you know, virtue or honor, these kind of things, which have really kind of disappeared from the way we understand, I think, happiness today.
Yeah, I mean, that's partly why I kind of admire the Nicomachean ethics broadly, and I love Aristotle's thoughts on that, on this whole concept of perfection, if we can put that in quotation marks, perhaps. But as you say, like, it's is it the telos in Aristotle's thought that's significant, as in the end point? Like, when you reach the end point, can we say about you that you are a virtuous, awesome person? And if we can't, then you're not. Then you haven't reached eudaimonia.
Yeah, that's right. So you're absolutely right. That's, eudaimonia is, it's understood teleologically. So it's the telos of human life, and it's, yeah, but it's a life, a human life is taken as a whole there. It's not just about like fleeting experiences, but the entire life understood in that way. I mean, I'm struggling with this a little bit, in the sense that I think, you know, people, it's not that people now have ceased to be worried about the whole of your life. It's not that it wouldn't be true to say, like, it's tempting for me to go, well, people are just worried about how they feel right now and they're not worried about it. That's not true. People are very worried about the future, but it's their worries that their pleasures will diminish. That their quality, I mean, people talk about quality of life. There is another worry, though, actually, with this. I mean, now I'm really just spitballing, but there is this big worry. I do talk about this in the book, with the euthanasia debate, about not just about pleasure, but about dignity. Like, so people don't want to suffer, but they also, as they want to put, they want to die. People want to die with dignity, which is exactly what, in a sense, Aristotle's talking about. But for him, I don't think dying. The problem is that I think that today, dignity is understood hedonistically. So if to die with dignity means, like, it would be undignified to die like suffering and gasping for breath or something like that. I don't think that's what, you know, the ancient Greeks thought was or wasn't dignified. You know, I think they would consider dignity the ability to bear your suffering.
Yep, agreed.
Whereas now it's like, no, we have to get rid of the suffering, or, like, you know, someone might look like they're having a bad time and that would be undignified. So sorry, I'm being a bit flippant about it.
No, I love it. Yeah, no, I get it. And I think we kind of have to break it down a little bit like that. But we're on the same page, I think, on that. Yeah. So I think that my point was just basically that I think there seems to be, and we've covered this, and I think you more or less agreed that Foucault seems to be kind of, in this sense, then perhaps reviving a sort of return to thinking about the bigger issue of happiness, rather than just, you know, losing sight of what deeper meanings are possible For those who are willing or wanting to find out, explore. So I think we're kind of okay on that. Yeah. So let me ask you another question, because it on in your book, obviously you have this consistent argument that and it's from the beginning, and it just builds up and finishes as well. Norms are closely tied to ideals. So, for example, you're very careful to dissociate norms from a formal rule or average, as you say. And then you sort of say things about in your a further claim you make by way of your observations and research into norms is that norms are an invention, and I like that word, invention. And they will therefore inevitably change. So this is another thing that sort of made me sort of stop, pause, and think. So the connection between norms and ideals, I guess, that's one thing. And the other thing is that norms are essentially an invention, and thus they must and have to change. You put it much more eloquently. Again, if I may quote you, the critical force of my argument does depend to an extent on norms being an invention, and hence being something that might reasonably be expected to disappear. This is from page 10. But if I may, I want to take this a little bit further by reading something else you say in that paragraph, and maybe use it to little push back on you a little bit. So you say, we are today so dominated by norms that it no longer seems conceivable that things could ever have been otherwise, or ever could be again. End quote. How do you feel about that now that I'm reading it
Big, big contrast.
to
Yeah, well,
you?
it's no. I mean, I think I'm deliberately trying to just juxtapose those there. If I'm, maybe I'm being, defensive. But I think, I think no, that both things are true. I think that on the one hand, so if you do the historical analysis, I must. I mean, I feel like I haven't done enough historical analysis in the book to be like 100% certain about some of the historical claims there, because I need to do more work in the history, the more Foucauldian style deep archival work, which I haven't done. But certainly this is the premise of the book, and the intuition of the book is that norms are, as and this is straight from Foucault. It's not what he says about norms, but what he says about the human man is an invention of a recent date, and one perhaps nearing its end. So I'm paraphrasing Foucault
Right.
there. Foucault in the
Okay.
Order of Things, when he talks about man, when I talk about norms being something that might be reasonably expected to disappear. That's so I'm paraphrasing Foucault's anti-humanism. So and the but yeah the but I absolutely think, and the same is would be true, not that it's an observation Foucault particularly makes, but this is not paraphrasing Foucault, but when we talk about humanity, this is a concept that we it's not one we can imagine either not having, or that people didn't used to have. It seems very counterintuitive that people didn't used to have a concept of humanity. It's something that Foucault says. I mean, I don't want to get into the debate about humanity, but yeah, I don't. It's when we go back to the ancient Greeks, I think this is the greatness of what Foucault does with the second and third volumes of his History of Sexuality, which, not his best books, I think, but the ones those are his only books published as books during, I suppose say during his lifetime. Actually, they were published posthumously. So, oh no, that's not quite. I guess they came out on his deathbed. But yeah, the greatness of those books is that they stress how totally unlike our contemporary culture, ancient Greek culture, was. It doesn't really make sense to us. The coordinates are just totally different, and that. Yeah, this idea of, I mean, this is the kind of deep Foucauldian thing, going back to Kongian, the idea that our culture is just does things in a really absolutely different way to earlier cultures, and we but we don't appreciate it, because when we look at the past, when we try and understand history, we think of them as being basically like us but with some differences.
Right.
And I yeah, but obviously the supposition in my book is no, they didn't. People didn't have norms. They just had rules, so they weren't constantly trying to achieve perfection in, you know, all these areas, which is the thing, the ideal, you know, the idea that I have, I say about norms coming from Foucault, is this idea that, I mean, everywhere, area of human life in our society, there's, whether we know it or not, there's a norm which we work to, and that norm is a standard of perfection which no one ever can fully obtain. As I argue that this was never the case until the modern period, that people historically, they followed the rules, they did what they were supposed to do, but they didn't feel that they had to be perfect. They were just trying to, you know, do the things they had to do. I mean, the long history here, and getting back to Christianity, includes Christianity because, as we've already noted, Christianity, and it's following from Plato, and it's a very old thing, has an idea of perfection, but it's an idea of perfection that you can't reach. So, because this world is imperfect. So therefore, you know, if you're a Christian, in a sense, you were trying to be perfect, but you knew you couldn't do it. And so that is part of the deep history of norms, but that's a huge sea change between the pre-modern period. People, yes, were people who were trying to be very holy were trying to be as perfect as they could be, but knowing they weren't going to get there. The problem of the norm is that it's understood, as I say, as normal, right? That is, even though it's an impossible vision of perfection that we want people to attain in our society, it's understood to be, in a weird way, the expectation. You're supposed to actually be perfect. It's not like this is some reach goal that, okay, I'll never get there, but I'm trying to get there. It's an asymptote that I aim towards. It's like, no, you should already be normal. You should already be, you know, I don't know, I hesitate to come up with an example. Have we had one? I mean, you should already be completely healthy. You know, if you have one, you know, bunion on your foot, you're okay, you need to go to the doctor. This needs to be sorted out. We need to have complete health. And
Yeah, and I think this is really critical. This is really important. Sort of pointing at that in the introduction, I was kind of playing with the ideas of, you know, how we can apply a norm and how we can think about norm, I guess, into sort of grades or colors or shades. Norms in terms of what? In terms of, say, the military absolutely needing a standard, or a game of soccer, you know, a team that has a standard. Without it, it's just chaos. Or norm, as in, like what you say, like these perfections on our body. If there's a slight imperfection, we must rectify it immediately. Otherwise, we're at risk of being singled out. You know, oh, look, you know, he's got a wart on his face or something like this. There's a lot more here, that I'd love to unpack with you, in particular with ref in reference to the great example of Christianity, as you say, the sort of consistent example of Christianity that you use in your book. And one thought I had there was in relation, just as you were speaking, is this question for you: what would you say if I were to play the devil's advocate and said, well, which is healthiest, the older model or this new model?
Yeah, I mean, I'm afraid. No,
Am I putting you on the spot?
it's. But I'm afraid I'm going to give, you know, the answer I give. My sincere answer is kind of a non-answer because of the incommensurability between different historical periods. So, if we, because there's one thing. I mean, it's the obvious. Because obviously, I'm complaining in some sense
Me
about the
too.
contemporary world, right? Yeah, I mean, yeah, for sure. But yeah, so I'm criticizing it. The obvious thing to say would be, well, things used to be better in the old days, let's go back to the old days. But that's not really clear, and I don't think it can be clear because there's just not a yardstick, right? Like, there's not a norm. I mean, you could say, There's no basis for saying so. Either we could try and have we could try and put this effectively, right? We could say, oh, people were happier in the old days, and people
Right.
that but people do say this. I mean, but that's a very
Yes.
perverse move, right? If you go, oh, people are happier in the old days, you then use this modern hedonistic standard to say actually modernity is bad because it failed, and maybe it does. It fails to make people. In a sense, it has failed because it's failed to be perfect. So
Well,
it's failed by its own standards.
maybe
But
it's, sorry to interrupt, but
yeah,
maybe
no,
it's,
please.
but maybe it's failed because it's made people happier. That sounded better in my head.
Well, no, it could, but sure, but it has. I mean, if happiness isn't
We've gotten
your.
hooked on happiness. So it's just we're craving more happiness and more ha like you said, this hedonistic individual that emerges in your book, as a
But
category.
there's a, I mean, there's a well-known, I can't think what thinker to index this to, but there's a well-known paradox of hedonism,
Right.
which is that, you know, if you chase pleasure, you will actually not have a good time.
Right.
So that's a, and that for sure is something we're experiencing today. So you could, yeah, you could argue that people had were even by contemporary standards of hedonistic standards actually doing better when they weren't so hedonistic. I think that's true, but on the other hand, it's impossible to really substantiate it, right? I mean, there's this terrifying area of ethics. There's certain. I mean, you're probably familiar with utilitarianism in ethics, which is in its classical form, was developed by Jeremy Bentham, all about pleasure maximization and what Bentham called a hedonic calculus, where you try and calculate how much pleasure people get. And there are genuinely encountered philosophers who are engaged in trying to calculate how much pleasure people get so that you can go, well, this is more pleasurable than that. This is the more pleasurable way of doing things. I'm pretty sure you can't do that. Like, I'm pretty sure there isn't, you can't actually do a calculation even of pleasure. But of course, even saying pleasure is the goal is very question begging.
Right.
So yeah, basically I just don't think I don't think we can possibly know by any metric, unless, I mean, if you had very specific ones, if you say, you know, here is a specific thing about modern world which is bad and it didn't exist in the past, I guess, okay, sure, that's true. But yeah, to say this society is happier or better is impossible. And of course, that's one reason why people now resort to these biological metrics, right? Because you can say, we can prove that people are healthier, right? That they live longer now than they used to. I mean, and but this seems to be above question. I mean, I talk about it in the book. I mean, the only, you know, pleasure is the only thing you could really argue against that. You could say, well, I want to live for a shorter span of time, but I want to be happier during that. The problem is you can't verify the happiness, right? It's not objective. So you can't actually be sure that's true if you live 10 years shorter for more pleasure. But this idea, it seems completely crazy to say now, but I'm harking back to Nietzsche again, that living, that what there's no point in living 100 years if there's no point to your life, right? So you need something to so you know something to something else. Consequently, it's always entirely possible to say, well, people now live longer, but like really, but as I say, in the end, that's a still a non-answer, because in the end, you can't know that people in the past really, on average, were felt the larger, more
Oh
purposeful.
yeah, I think you're absolutely right on that. There's no way we can get metrics on it. I guess as you know me from a history of ideas background, I'm kind of thinking more sort of long-term processes of ideas and places and people in a way that they're generally described. And another sort of thing that occurred to me as you were speaking is I guess what I'm saying is in a way it seems to me from reading you and listening to you that happiness is central, right? However you quantify it and describe it. And it seems to me that this goal of humanity, if we may call it a goal of human, I think I feel comfortable enough to say it's a goal of human beings to want to be happy, has kind of almost maybe come to fruition in a very fruitful way, sorry, abundant way. So there's happiness all around. Like there's no shortage of happiness, say, in a modern society where everything's available. There's conveniences, there's stability, there's so any society that we will define as functioning and organized and so on and so forth, that therein any citizen can find an abundance of opportunity to be happy, to find happiness. Now that may be the question there, like what kind of happiness? You know, is it just in being able to eat an endless supply of ice cream or varieties of pizza and other kinds of foods, whatever, you know, or whether there's an incredibly amazing large library that's locally available or full of philosophy books, and they can sit and read Plato and Aristotle because they can, because, you know, they're a multi-million dollar podcaster or something, you know, so they have the luxury of that, you know, so on and so forth. Do you kind of,
Yeah,
what do you
yeah,
think?
no, I know. It's, I keep thinking about the American Constitution, you know, the
Right.
life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I mean,
Yep,
this is
yep.
the old joke that it's only the pursuit of happiness, not the actual happiness, is guaranteed. But yeah, sure.
Sure,
But
yeah.
people, I mean, like you're talking about people are going to pursue happiness in their own way or their own idea of that. I mean, sure, this is liberalism we're talking about, really. Is you advocating that though, Milad, or is this just an observation?
I'm just making an observation again, like just thinking about the kind of things that we've been saying. It seems to me that human beings, even historically, have sought happiness, and perhaps one could argue that a lot of battles or wars, violences have occurred because of the seeking of happinesses or pleasures, if we want to put it in a more crude way, such as conquest and booty,
Are
expansion.
those, I mean, are they, is that, but again, I mean, this strikes me as a very modern reading. Like, you know, it's sorry to
True.
be, to, maybe a bit unfair
Guilty.
to, but
Guilty.
below the belt. But I think that's because we go, I mean,
Guilty.
this is a standard practice in history, I think, this kind of, this naturalizing or this, you know, the attempt to read history is always about material concerns, because that's how we do things today, you know, like, I guess, any, you know, the Crusades were really about money or, you know, like something like this, that there's, the actual the stated motives of people at the time are not the real ones. I mean, this is something methodologically Foucault's very against. You know, this he has we have to actually when you read what someone says, you have to look at the words they're actually using and not attempt to interpret behind that to like some, you know, because at that point you're inventing. You know, you're just reading your beliefs onto them. And yeah, so I think in the past, I think history is very strange. I think history is fundamentally strange to us. I mean, the example I always think about this, now struggling to remember the name, but you know, in Western Europe in the Middle Ages, people used to wall themselves up in the walls
Yes,
of churches. So
yes,
I
yes,
can't
yes.
remember what the name of that practice was,
I
but
can't either.
that's for contemporary by contemporary standards, this is just a completely incomprehensible behavior.
Absolutely.
Like it's, but it, but history is replete with that. Historical societies, cultures, of course, this is true not just of historical ones, but contemporary ones, insofar as there may be some contemporary societies that haven't managed to stay outside of the global culture, which obviously is decreasingly the case. They behave in ways that simply don't make sense to us and can't be computed either according to a hedonistic or a materialist calculus, which obviously are quite closely related. I mean, this is, and of course, the truth is that you know, our ability to understand our own motives now, it's inevitably inadequate. So the reality is that now we may understand ourselves as being, you know, I'm, you know, a rational economic agent who's trying to get more money. I'm, you know, just trying to get more pleasure. Actually, people are trying to do something more than that, even though they may not realize it.
Let me thank you, and I appreciate that response. Let me just get back to the point about invention of norms and that connection between norm and ideal. And I guess I kind of wanted to ask you about whether you are saying that norms must change because they aren't created by us, but can we get a little bit more specific there? I mean, is it so? My question in my mind was more like, is it something that happens on its own, or is it something this change of norms, or is it something that's enforced somehow on
Yeah,
us.
so I mean, my answer on that's a little bit weak. I mean, on the one hand, I want to stress again the wording I used paraphrasing Foucault, right? It's not that we definitely know that norms are going to disappear. It's that we can reasonably expect them to. So because they haven't been around for very long, sooner or later, it seems likely that some other social form will emerge. But that's not a guarantee.
Right, okay.
We don't know because we don't know what's going to obtain in the future. So maybe norms will be, incredibly long-lived as a form, and they're clearly very adaptable. I mean, I do talk about this. They're able to change, and as I see it today, the form of the norm has really recolonized some very anti-normative tendencies that you would think that very adversely present themselves as being very anti-normative, but actually are profoundly normalizing. I'm struggling to remember the final part of what you were asking. Sorry, my lad.
Oh, I was, in what I was saying is essentially our norms. I guess my question basically is, if norms are created and they're linked to ideals, are they, who's it created by?
Yeah, but this is
How did they come about? Come on,
well.
Mark, help me with this question.
It's the Illuminati, my lad, don't you know?
Oh, I knew it.
Anyway, but my answer, this was extremely weak. Like, it's the weakest answer. But as far as I can perceive, I don't think there's a general answer to this question. And but specifically, I mean, the who question, in a sense, I mean, is I'm going to be Foucauldian. It's kind of a bad question in the sense that, like, we're talking about broad social forms. They're not. They don't typically have an inventor. I mean, so although norms are an invention, they're an invention of society or of, rather than being an invention like a technological invention might be invented by an individual. No, yeah, norms aren't an invention in that personalized sense. They're an invention in the sense that they're created by human beings. But yeah, it's not also clear to me at all. And I guess I shouldn't. Maybe this is just my failing. As I say in the book, it would be great. I'd really welcome it if someone could explain, come up with a theory of how norms are produced. But I don't think there is likely to be any general theory. And I think it depends on the norm. So when it comes to, medical norms, I mean, if you look at the history of medicine, you can probably work out where they come from and who's doing the things. But although it still remains quite nebulous, I mean, norms in particular areas, because there are areas where norms are relatively stated and you can kind of find out how they're being produced a little bit, and there's areas where people are barely even aware they exist on my account. Certainly they're being produced by human beings, but exactly how, I mean, it's a question. You could refer it to the question of the production of culture in general, right? I mean, culture is it's produced collectively by people. And yes, you can identify certain individuals who are culturally influential, who maybe, shape the culture in a certain way, but generally not deliberately, I think. And even then, it's a little bit unclear because you'd have to talk not just about, if you talk about someone who's influential on the culture, you have to ask why they're influential and what are the forces that are causing people to be influenced by them. I mean, it's not a matter if someone's influential on other people, it's not a matter if they've gone out and like grabbed people and forced them to be influenced. This has to be something that makes them receptive in the first place. So, to have a general theory of norm formation is I don't think it's possible to do. What I say in the book is my suspicion. As I say, it'd be fantastic if someone could come up with them. But as far as I can work out, you don't know what's going to happen with norms. They will emerge, and you can talk about them and criticize them, but you don't know where the next one's going to come from. Basically, maybe you can kind of start to see them emerging, like you could get in early on it, but that's I mean, the one thing you can say with norms though is, I mean, the extent to which they'll have to, and this isn't an observation about norms really, this is an observation about power relations. I'm going back to Foucault, and what I was talking before is going back to Foucault, which is, if you're going to have a new structure in society, it's going to have to work with the existing framework more or less. So I think there are moments in the book where I say this. I mean, if you want to have, a new, if someone wants to, if someone wants, for example, and the example I give, and I'm sorry, I keep going back to this, but the example of the discourse around weight, sizeism, fat shaming. This attempt, there's an attempt there to there's an attempt by to kind of push back on the medical normalization of body weight. But there's the stakes of this are very difficult because you the norm of health is very ingrained in our society. Like in a sense, it's the original norm in our normative framework because we medicine's so important. So there's got to be to if you're really gonna I feel that that discourse has faltered. Like it's a situation where that someone's trying to push against a norm and they can only get so far with it. And in order to you can see how the strategic situation is, that you can see that this norm of body weight is connected to a whole edifice of like medical normalization. And you're either going to have like and we have this, we have these kind of exceptions that are made in the medical framework. Occasionally there'll be an area where the effective, and this is no one's made this decision, I think, explicitly, but effectively the medical establishment's like, well, this is just too hot to handle. We're gonna just stop being worried about whether this is medically normal or not. We'll just let people do whatever because it's just too controversial. So there could be a kind of exception carved out where the doctors are just too scared to say anything about human body weight anymore. Now that's one possibility, because there's, as I say, there's actually a kind of is a war almost, right? There's a tension between the norms of health and pleasure, and there's a constant attempt. Obviously, everyone would really like a solution, like a technological fix, like that will let everyone just be have all the pleasure and have all the health, right? But we clearly don't have one at all. So there's this constant tension. What I suggest in the book is that the norm of pleasure tends to win. It's actually more important in a certain sense in our society. But but it couldn't be allowed to win completely because the consequences would be so dire. Like it would, yeah. Anyway, sorry, I mean, this is a
No,
roundabout way of
you're
answering your
fine.
question.
And this kind of leads me into asking you about the conflicting norms that you identify in the book, the individualism and hedonism. And you just began to sort of unpack this a little bit. Do you want to explain that for us a little bit
Yeah, I
more?
mean, the individualism and hedonism don't have the same kind of conflict between them that health and hedonism do because. Being selfish and hedonistic, like that's a pretty obvious. They kind of go together pretty well. Like it's not really that doesn't really it causes problems only in the way really. I can't actually remember exactly what I said about this in the book, but it causes problems only in the way that hedonism itself is paradoxical, right? So if you spend all your time chasing pleasure, actually it's not going to be that productive to pleasure because pleasure is. Effectively, something incidental you accrue. I mean, this is the philosophical paradox of it, right? You get pleasure by achieving things that feel meaningful to you, right? I mean, obviously you can get it in other ways by just eating some ice cream or something, but broadly speaking, if you need to have a much more holistic approach actually to appreciate pleasure and feel happy, even if we're going to approach it as an affect. So, actually, to once you make happiness the goal, there's a word for this. It's nihilism. What, at that point, you actually disappear into a spiral. I mean, actually, you're likely to become depressed if your only goal in life is to feel pleasure because it's actually not satisfying itself. But the individualism thing, it's effectively the same phenomenon in the sense that, I mean, individualism itself is paradoxical because, no man is an island. Like, actually, your sense of yourself is actually socially constructed. You're not independent of other people. You need other people as an individual in all kinds of ways. You're human beings are social beings. It's actually not. And the same paradox occurs with hedonism. So if when you put the two together, so if I as an individual, I'm going to just seek my own pleasure, well, that's idiotic in the literal sense, right? Idios in Greek, it's the one who's by himself, right? So it's idiotic in the sense that you're ignoring the thing that would make you happy, which is other people and their interests. I mean, actually, you'll be happier if you, concern yourselves with the well-being of others. Then that actually would probably lead to a happier result than being selfishly concerned with your own interests. I mean, this is what I tell my 3-year-old all the time, but he doesn't seem to get it.
Mm-hmm. It's advice you could tell me anytime because I seem to. I don't know if I'm reading Kierkegaard correctly, but I take him to be extremely individualistic in his approach.
That's right.
So I've sort of fallen into the vortex of Kierkegaard a little bit, and I often find it hard to get out of.
That's really interesting. I'm a big fan of Kierkegaard, but yeah,
Sorry,
that rings true. That really, no,
that
it really does. I mean, it makes me, yeah, okay. That's really interesting.
yeah, I love his writings, obviously, in relation to, what are the standards of his day in terms of the Christianity of his time and his world. And then he's sort of calling that out as kind of maybe pretentious, might not be the exact word, but yeah, and then he's kind of falling into this individualism or promoting this kind of individualism. And I know Kierkegaard is not the subject of our discussion today, but
No, but there's a yeah. Who's making these rules? Not me.
I'm not establishing
There's
norms.
but there's there's the but there's not no. But the problem is there's these norms floating around. But I think the question that it raises in my mind really is the smaller orthodoxy of Kierkegaard as a Christian. But actually, I think to try and defend Kierkegaard, I think actually what we're talking about here is a paradox of Christianity that not is not a bad thing. But actually, the Christianity classically says you should devote yourself entirely to helping other people and putting yourself last
Yes.
because that will lead to your personal salvation and eternal happiness, right? So actually, I think there's it's not that it's not necessarily wrong. What Kierkegaard's saying is precisely, you can make the leap of faith, you can make the decision, and you basically determine your own reality in this sense, right? I'm sorry, it's like a
Yes.
self-help kind of thing. But you make the decision to have faith, and that will transform your life. It's true. I think it's probably fair to say that Kierkegaard was not sufficiently focused on the charitable aspects of like Christian life. But nonetheless, I mean, if you're like a Kierkegaardian knight of faith, I mean, I'm not sure. I always think about Fear and Trembling with Kierkegaard, but
Yes, me too.
okay, good. Okay, they're on the same page. Like, because
Of
there's other Kierkegaards, but.
course.
Yeah, if you're like a knight of faith, then I mean you're going to be like a nice you're going to be nice to people, right? This is so it but yeah, fundamentally it's about transforming yourself.
Yes.
In the par but yeah, it's the reverse of the hedonistic paradox. It's the exact opposite. But I think is I mean here I'm going to, say this actually is correct, right? The hedonistic paradox is you try to experience pleasure, but you will end up unhappy. The paradox of Christianity is that but it's I mean it's like a more complicated paradox. You're motivated in a sense by you could even say hedonistic, right? You could even say like your desire to enter the kingdom of God could even be like a hedonistic
Absolutely.
motivation, right? You could say, well, okay, I'm gonna like Pascal's wager, I'll give up my happiness in this world, but I'll enjoy eternity of bliss. Okay, that's fine, but actually that the paradox is that in this life you actually probably will be happier doing that, even though if you accept suffering. I mean, I hear because we've really circled back to your question before about forms of life. Yeah, I think we probably can say that's like a more effective strategy. Like self-denial. I mean, it goes back to Aristotle in a weird way, because it's something that Aristotle says is like specific advice for people, but really is kind of universal advice. Like Aristotle has this, he has the metaphor of the ship. If your ship is like if you're a ship, and if you're going to hit like one bank of the river, you've got to steer towards the other bank, right? So if you're very selfish, you need to like do some charitable donations, get yourself away from the pernicious danger of selfishness. I think I mean, the point of which like Christianity is not Aristotelian at all, because it doesn't admit there's like a negative on the other side. For a classical Greek perspective, there is like if you were just giving away all your money and you became poor, that would be bad.
Yes.
From a Christian point of view, that actually would be good. Like, there's no limit. But I think it's also the case that both like that limit is not very dangerous. Basically, the overwhelming majority of people are so inclined towards selfishness. That advice is good advice for almost everyone, and very like there's very, very little danger. you're going to hit the other shore. Like you're very likely to run aground on selfishness, but not on. I'm really, we're not talking about Kiko at all anymore. Anyway.
No, I love it. It's taken a good turn. And I think, as you say, it kind of works in a clever way. It's the bait for getting things right in a way. So let me I'm kind of conscious of time, and I just wanted to kind of now ask you a little bit about your sort of final statements of the book in the book. I was thinking about what you mentioned about medieval fantasies in the conclusion. And I think this kind of relates to some of the things that we've been saying, and it sort of covers off everything in a way and perhaps allows us to have some final thoughts on the issue. I understand you say that this they these this such as medieval fantasies, these things, these ideas, our perceptions of the past in a way threaten to be normative themselves, by which you mean that they that a return to the past is not possible, right? This is kind of what you have already outlined for us, right? And I generally agree with you. I mean, history, as you said, is a strange thing. It's a strange beast, and doing history is often strange. I can't find another word for strange. It's strange. What am I doing? How can I possibly know about the past that I've never experienced, let alone comment on it, so on and so forth. What can I ask you to explain a little bit more about what you wanted to get at with this kind of statement about time and history and human understanding?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two people. I mean, like, there's two audiences I'm addressing here. Like, one is really myself, because my temptation is precisely to go, the past was better. Like,
Me
this is a
too.
temptation I have, right? So, and but also, like, there's a concrete, I'm very online. Like, there are people. I mean, there's I'm sure there are always people like this, but I think the. You now really find people coagulating with weird views as communities online. So you find, that there are people who are various species of trad, right? So they people who want to go back to the 1950s, people who want to go back to the 19th century, or people who want to go back to the Middle Ages. And then particularly if you find, the traditional Catholics, advocate some kind of, it's very unclear, like, they want to go back to Franco Spain, do they want to go back to the pre-Reformation Europe? I don't know, but I'm not sure they know themselves. The warning here is what I'm saying is pretty simple, which is, I mean, actually I didn't spell it out in this way, but I'll spell it out this way now. If you start trying to move towards the past, that is just creating another form of impossible vision of the future. It's utopianism. And it's just as utopian as if you're, any other variety of utopian. If you're a communist, or if you, it doesn't matter. If you say the future will look like this, so firstly, this is normative political theory. So I wrote a book about this, called For Foucault Against Normative Political Theory, before I wrote the more recent one. So, but yeah, this is what political thought largely consists in, is having this norm of the future, norm for society. This is what I want society to look like, and this is what I will move towards. And that for me, I mean, the real reason I think that's wrong is it's self-defeating, because you don't get it. The thing, you will not realize that utopian vision. So all that can ever do, and here I'm like, Foucault kind of almost says this explicitly. I'm really riffing on Foucault, but yeah, like, all you will ever do is provide an excuse for a society that fundamentally doesn't look like that it's heading towards it. So the classic example, of course, would be the Soviet Union. The excuse of the Soviet Union is, we're trying to have, like, communism, with no laws or state or money, or like, there's nothing like that. It's like, it's so, but societies in general now, I think, work this way. They have, like, a norm. They're like, okay, our society, like, Australia isn't perfect, but, like, we're trying to have this society which would look good on paper. And it's not quite as fantastical, but it's still based on a kind of liberal vision which we'll never actually obtain. And I think that any vision of that nature has the function of disguising reality, and actually of therefore it excuses like the dysfunction of the politics of the present. So yeah, you basically yeah, normative politics is bad. I mean, that's a perverse normative stance that I take on this issue. Foucault put it very succinctly. He says he has one, I don't know if he says the word normative, but one commandment, which is never do politics.
Goodness. Would you take that as an anti-Aristotelian stance?
Foucault's of mine.
Sorry, that's just kind of
You're
left wing.
thinking,
That was right out of left field.
is it? I mean, we're off the ethics, I suppose. Yeah, I mean, it's got me thinking about Aristotle's politics, and I'm struggling to remember where to fit that in.
I mean,
It's
what the
actually anti-Platonistic because the
right.
Republic is the original normative political theory. So
Okay.
it's, but it's, yeah, it's anti-Plato when he talked, because that's the, what I was saying about Platonism before is Plato's, his account of forms. It's like, no, this world isn't perfect. We're gonna, but actually, when he starts in the Republic, and think this perhaps is not the most, it's the most obvious thing about the Plato's Republic, but not the thing people talk about the most. He starts giving all these directions for an ideal society, which are more or
Exactly.
less crazy, not just by modern standards, but by Greek standards. And yeah, that's he shouldn't. That's not good. Like that's because that's an attempt to for me, that's like that's if you want to find the oldest example of someone doing normative thinking, it's there in Plato's Republic when he starts.
Great. I was intrigued by a remark that you made in the last pages of your book in terms of your agreement with Lacan that, quote, that the only repository of sufficient resources here is likely to be religion, even if I can hardly rule out other possible bases for the counterattack. And even though a pivot towards religion must look alarmingly like a simple reactionary move to restore the status quo, anti-norms. Is that, did I quote it correctly? Would you like to comment a little bit on this?
Yeah, so I don't know which, but you want me to talk about what Lacan says about religion or that, because the I mean the bit about the looking alarming like the status quo ante, and there's a big crossover. Like the people who are arch traditionalists tend to be very religious. People who, very religious. I mean I firstly I struggle with this tendency myself, but when you it's some you see this online I mean certainly alarms me is young guys who are very into religion, but are then they have a very politicized understanding of this, and that is that to me. I mean, of course, this has a very different valence in different religions. I mean, in Christianity, it alarms me because I don't think that's what Christianity actually is about. And historically, it isn't. I mean, historically, what you had, yeah, you had all these Christian states run by Christian rulers, but that wasn't because Christianity set out to do that. It's an artifact that happened when Christianity became endemic, and like particularly in the Roman Empire, like once you had Constantine, then you had to have this way of doing things. It's not. It's a kind of accident. It's a bug in Christianity. Certain other religions, we might not. It's more of a feature. But yeah, it's that's alarming to me, and that's obviously not what I'm enjoying. So because I think what I'm enjoying at the end is in line with what Foucault says, personal, ethical, ascetical practices. So you cannot hope to, because you cannot as an individual hope to overthrow the society of the norm. There's no clear political path to doing this. It just doesn't exist because we don't really understand well enough how it works. You couldn't have President Trump, I mean, yesterday signing all these executive orders, perhaps you've seen, and but he can't sign like an executive order against norms. This is maybe in a sense that's what he's trying to do, but I don't think so. I mean, I talk about Trump a lot in the book, of course,
Yes, you do.
but I mean,
We haven't talked about it. I'm sorry.
side note, the publisher wanted me to take that out when the
Oh,
book came
really?
out because they were like, look, Trump, he's not president anymore. He's going to disappear into
Wow.
history.
No
And
big mistake.
I
Yeah.
was, well, yeah, fortunately, I kept it in because I it wasn't actually because I thought they were wrong. It's because I couldn't think how to rewrite the chapter. But anyway, I look vindicated by history there in a horrible way. But in any case, but yeah, you can't, there's no political solution to use the online rubric. So there's no political solution to the problem of norms. All you can do is find a way to navigate them as an individual through ethical practices. Of course, you can do that. I mean, I don't want to be an individualist about it. So of course you can be, you can do it in community with others. Indeed, you should, right? You should certainly try and reach out to other people. But that's not a kind of political thing. But there is something else I said there. You want me to talk about Lacan specifically as
Well,
well?
I think it would be helpful for us to understand the connection with Lacan, and then just I was sort of wanting to underline sufficient resources. So repository, religion, this reference to religion. Yeah, that would be great.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, it's a little bit hard to know exactly what Lacan means by this. So it's a quite a marginal text. It's a little book in English with two texts. It's called, it has a revolution in the title. I'm actually struggling now to remember what the book is called. It's the second part of it is called A Discourse to Catholics. The Triumph of Religion is what it's called
Triumph,
by
yeah.
Lacan. So it's a I think a lecture he gave to a Catholic audience at a Catholic university in Belgium. But people like it, it's something that the Lacanians struggle with because generally most Lacanians are like deeply atheistic. Whereas, I mean, Lacan, he wasn't like a regularly observant Catholic, but he was a Roman Catholic. He had a Catholic funeral. His brother was a priest. He never announced his Catholicism. And then he did make these comments. And he made these comments that psychoanalysis, is nothing compared to religion. It's far more powerful. People don't understand how powerful it is, how deep its resources go. So he predicts that, and more than science as well. He has these kind of negative things to say about it. He's like, oh, all this like the scientists with their idea, destroying the world with genetic engineering. They're pathetic. They're not going to do anything. Religion is the thing for Lacan. He thinks it's almost for him the most powerful force there is. Exactly why he says that I find harder to substantiate. I mean, we talk about the resources, but I mean, but obviously I have said this, so I should substantiate it. But we talk
Please.
about the resources. Well, really, really, look, I mean, we haven't really touched upon this. I mean, I know there's maybe some contention about this, but obviously religion doesn't have the status it did in the past, right? It's so in Western societies, but it retains enormous. I mean, like if you look at it naturalistically, obviously there's. I mean, if we include God here, then obviously religion's resources overwhelm any other. So if you take a religious point of view on it, then obviously religion's going to win because it has God on its side. So, but that, I mean, that kind of goes without saying. But if we look at it from a kind of purely secular materialist point of view, like religion has immense kind of cultural, also institutional resources in the society still. So if you're going to look to something that you can find that has, some kind of resource against norms, I don't think there's anything that approaches it in our society. I mean, it's funny because religions are kind of holdover from this pre-normative period. Not entirely, because of course a lot of religion has, in a sense, become really infiltrated by this normative way of thinking. So it's not like it's. But on the other hand, it does retain these resources. There are parts of religion that remain outside of these circuits to a large extent, haven't fully absorbed them. If you want to find, if you want to find, because if I put it this way, what I was saying before, if you as an individual want to just, do it all yourself and like find a way to resist norms, I mean, this is very hard. I think I mean, essentially impossible. You need to go to something else, and of course, some people read Marcus Aurelius or something. Like you can find like philosophical resources in the past to do this, but if you wanted to, and I was suggesting you should do it in a communal way, then religion basically is there's nothing like it, think. I think you assume you'd agree with me from that, right?
Absolutely, yeah. As a religion scholar, I cannot but agree. So yeah, I mean, I was really intrigued by that. And just incidentally, you don't describe religion as a historical form of norm. Is that correct?
Yeah, no, it's an older, it's a rules-based
Rules-based,
system,
yep.
right? So
Okay,
yeah,
yeah.
like it's, but like all systems were, like government law, all that stuff was rules-based before they had norms.
Understood.
As I said, I mean, Christianity is a little bit on the cusp because like Jesus Christ is almost a norm.
I
Like
understand.
the difference is that Jesus Christ's behavior is normative, but with the caveat that you're not generally expected to actually, like, you're going to try, but you're not going to get there.
Right.
And in this life.
Yes. Despite books that you mentioned, such as The Imitation of Christ, I think you quoted that book.
Yeah, so it's
Am I right? Did I
Thomas
remember that
Aquinas.
correctly? Yeah, Thomas
Thomas
Kempis.
Aquinas. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but because I say that, but I give that as an example because it's rules based. So it
Yes.
doesn't. It
I
says, well,
see.
you've got to imitate Christ, which is a kind of like a normative principle.
But it's
But the
essentially
way
setting up
it,
the rules.
well, it substantiates it by
Yeah. Yeah.
saying, you do this, you do this, you do this.
Got it.
So it, yeah, like, which is not the, you know, one of the things I think is tyrannical about contemporary norms is that they don't tell you what to do. I mean, you just get the, you're like, okay, you've got to be like this. How? I don't know. There's no steps to follow. You're just like, okay, you've got to be like this. If you don't do it, you're bad. Well, then that's kind of horrible, basically, to people because they're like, I'm not able to do it. I don't have a. Whereas I, you know, there's traditional. I mean, Catholicism actually, in a sense, is particularly strong in this regard because it's like, look, just do the things we tell you, and then
Yeah.
you'll be okay, and you don't have to worry too much about theosis or something. You know,
Right.
whether you're, it gives you a structure of behavior that as long as you do the things, you're going to be, and it will assure you. I mean, because Catholicism is also very good in this. It's like, okay, you're guaranteed salvation as long as you do these steps, which is kind of theologically problematic, perhaps, but I mean, I think anyone with familiarity with the difference between Christian denominations would, I think, agree that Catholicism very rules based.
Yes, yeah, I think that's a good description. That and that not as a, as that is a bad thing. I think it's very much, to my mind, as you describe it. I'm just loving this kind of sort of dynamic between norm and rule based, and how something can be defined as a norm or becomes a norm, and something is rule based and remains rule based, and how we draw the line between rule and norm.
Yeah, well, the case that's really interesting that I have a chapter on it, law in the book,
Yes.
is because my claim is if you go far enough with the rules, it ends up becoming a norm. If you just have this argues happen with the contemporary law because there's so many laws, no one has any,
That's right.
that literally no one knows how many there are.
Yeah.
So there's yeah, at a certain point. Like if you have the Ten Commandments, that's kind of clear. But if you once you have like nobody knows how many laws there are, then actually the law becomes like a norm. It's like a vague. We need to obey the law, but what is the law? I'm not totally sure what it is.
But if you follow the norm, you're kind of more or less following the
Yeah,
law.
but you. I mean, you can get horribly caught out. I mean, something I talk about. So I
Yes.
mean, you know,
Yes.
you can't be assured you're following the law today. I mean, people, you know, I could be breaking the law right now. I've really got no idea. I mean, you know. So, I mean, I don't know. Is my car parked within a meter of the curb? I can't remember. You know,
Right.
there's, I mean, but it, there's so many possible applicable laws. Like, am I following the entire tax code? I you know, it's,
Yeah.
so it's, I mean, it's a kind of a weird example because I think in a sense it's a norm that people aren't that concerned about what they're following. Like it functions a norm, but people, yeah, I don't know how much anxiety this really causes people. It certainly causes them a lot of anxiety when they get
Yeah.
acute, when they get like caught breaking the law and charged. Because in general, I think the, you know, all the norms now, we haven't really talked about this, but I think it's, I
Yes.
mean, except in with the paradox of hedonism, but it's people are very anxious because they have all these norms and they're not, you don't know, I don't know if I'm actually following the
Right.
norm. Yeah, with the law, I don't know how anxious people really are about whether they're following it. But I think that, you know, the horrible reality of the law now, I think, is basically it's just a tool of power, and If you're on the wrong side of the wrong people, they'll find a law to prosecute you, and that's and if you're not,
That's right.
they won't, and that's so if you're like me and you're sitting, I mean, but my anxiety is not about whether I'm following the law, it's about whether I'll end up being on the wrong side of the wrong people.
Yes, that's an anxiety perhaps all of us live with today. Mark, let me ask you one final thing about the book. And given that you spent time writing this book, researching it, this was part of an ARC research. Congratulations on that, from historical congratulations. I think that's a tremendous achievement, and the product is an extremely readable book, easy to get into. Raises so many questions, so I loved reading it, and it problematized for me this question of norm. And I don't think, to be absolutely honest, I don't think I have ever thought about the word norm or normal as much as I did when I was reading your book. And everywhere I turned, I started raising the questions that you do in the book. I was like, oh yeah, well, hang on, what's that? And recognizing the things that are normal to me as I'm doing them. For the first time, so it was a good experience. What would you like for your reader, or for the listener, to kind of take away from your engagement with this concept? Final thoughts.
No, it's really good. But yeah, I wonder what
And a big one.
what's the
Final
point?
thoughts,
Why have
Mark. What
you?
is the
No,
answer?
no, no. Yeah, well, yeah, we've kind of, I mean, we've canvassed that. Like, what should people actually do? I mean, I mean, it's yeah. I mean, I you know, you I'm pleased you couch this as a positive experience, because I could easily see this not being a pleasant experience to like oh no, look at all this normalization I'm exposed to. I mean, look, I. Yeah, I would like people to, in a paradoxical way, be able to reclaim their individuality. Because but I mean, I suggest at the end that this, the only way to be an individual today is actually by rejecting individualism.
Right. Wow.
That this
Okay.
is that's the paradoxical situation we've ended up with, because we haven't we talked about this, but the contemporary norms
Yes.
have become so individualistic. It didn't used to be the case. We used to when the in this so we've canvassed a little bit. Norms really in the modern sense were invented in this kind of threshold of modernity moment, late 18th century, when so many things changed. And initially, particularly in the 19th century, the norms were very, very rigorous. Like, it was like, do what you're told. Everyone's got to be like the norm says. Very explicit norms of behavior, enforced on people rigorously, physically. This is how 19th century institutions work. Today, norms are the exact opposite. I mean, the norms are they're nebulous, unstated. They encourage individualism. But this is why the subtitle of the book is Individualism as Conformity.
Yeah.
That you people used to just have conformity, but now you have compulsory individualism. Everyone has to be a unique and special individual, which is like a horrible burden. It's I mean, this goes back to like, wasn't it better in the old days? It was in the extent. Look, I mean, it depends who you were, right? In a sense, if you wanted to be very different to everyone else, living in a conformist society is very difficult. If you don't have a lot of particularly unique individual attributes, being in a society where everyone's required to be an individual is the burden. And I think, but I think, yeah, I think to now the only way to genuinely demonstrate, I mean, I guess this may not be true for people who naturally find the society we're in is a good venue for them to express themselves. So it's maybe, this may not be true for everyone, but I think in general that people can, in a sense, like have a liberatory experience by surrendering the or surrender is not the word I'm looking for, but the by like foregoing realizing they can opt out of the requirements to constantly be different and unique, that it's orienting yourself towards I mean what I don't know, I'm actually struggling to remember what I said in the book, but something else, right? It, rather, a principle outside of yourself
Yes.
can actually serve to liberate you.
Yes. Yes. Mark, I'm going to leave the listener with this thought because I think it's profound. I think it sort of goes to the core of your book, and I hope that it encouraged people to read your book. And I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time and spending the time with us today and answering
No,
my questions.
really, the gratitude is all mine, Milad. Thank you so much for your interest in the book. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for being on. Thank you. Friends, we appreciate you being with us today. You can listen to and share all our episodes and more on the Religious Studies Collective webpage. Just Google Religious Studies Collective WSU and select interviews. Thanks for listening. Catch you next time.